High Desert and the great American Southwest. I bid you all good evening, good morning, as the case may be across this great nation of ours. I'm Art Bell, and this is Coast to Coast and Beyond AM. Great to have you. And here I am again, after a long absence. But this, I hope, will be it, folks. I'm taking much better anti-spaz medicine and better anti-inflammatory medicine, and I'm standing up straight again, and there's every hope in the world that I am here to stay. This time, nobody hopes that more than I do. God, I'm glad to be back. I'm telling you, I have missed this so much. You'll never know. I would like to welcome a new affiliate, WAGN in Marionette, Wisconsin. 1340 on the dial there, and hello to the GM, Jeff Magner, and the PD, Jim Medley. Glad to have you on board the ever-growing network. Well, let's look at what's going on in the world briefly in Afghanistan. A lot has happened. We appear now to be winning the war since I last spoke to you. Every day I look at CNN now, I notice we have taken another city, but it's beginning to get not so easy. They're claiming they're going to be martyrs. The Taliban is going to martyr themselves, if necessary, die. They're blowing themselves up, attaching bombs to their bodies, rushing alliance lines and blowing themselves up. So they indeed intend to be martyrs in the fighting in these last cities. Kunduz, for example, is absolutely fierce, fierce fighting. So, and nevertheless, I would say, all in all, if you believe what you read in the American press, and on the score, I think you can, we seem to be winning the war. Will we get Osama bin Laden? Well, I don't know. They say they are closing the net on Osama. We shall see. You should shortly begin to perhaps feel safer in an aircraft. Air security law. Passing. More sky marshals. Various increases in security at airports that will probably hold you up a little more, but I don't think too many Americans mind. They know what's going on. The following is a kind of an uh-oh story. I think it's an uh-oh story. The United States accused Iraq, North Korea, and four other countries, and maybe more on Monday, of building germ warfare arsenals. And in fact, I received an interesting story on this from a listener. It says, here, the next phases of the war on terror after Afghanistan are going to be the real test to see if we make it past Type 1 civilization. Here's a piece of an article that was released today by our government. The strategy appears to be very broad. Geneva, the dateline is, in the wake of a worldwide anthrax scare, the U.S. said Monday, as I just read to you, that it has identified six countries trying to make biological weapons, and none of them, none, are friends of America. It is beyond dispute that Iraq has germ warfare program well underway. The U.S. strongly suspects North Korea, Libya, Syria, Iran, and Sudan of the same, according to our Under Secretary of State for Arms Control. So I think the emailer is correct. We are going to get a test to see if we can make it to a Type 1 civilization. Nobody ever said for sure that Element 92, surviving the discovery and the implementation of Element 92, was the exact measure. I think the measure is, does a civilization like ours survive its own mass weapons of destruction? And that doesn't have to be nuclear, of course. It could easily be biological. I'm sure you have seen some of the movies where something is set loose that virtually destroys humankind on the planet. It could happen. Maybe not with anthrax, but some other little bug they might let loose, something they have developed, something the wrong people get hold of. So, we're we're going to watch this story very closely. It could easily be the measure of whether you you make it to a Type 1 civilization or not. I received this email I thought pretty interesting. Dear Mr. Bell, seldom do I email any radio host to share an opinion or information. However, this will be an exception to the rule because you of all people will understand. Currently, I'm living outside Atlanta, Georgia, in practice with three other physicians in the area. My training is primarily in family practice, and have come to really appreciate being a country doctor in a rural setting. A few weeks ago, one of my patients told me that she had been experiencing some pretty unusual things in her home, not knowing what to make of it. I invited her to tell me the entire story, start to finish. From psychics for money to ministers with scorn, she felt there was no relief for her situation. While surfing the internet, she came across a group out of Athens, Georgia, who claimed to be very well versed in this area, and she wasted no time in contacting them. Unfortunately, the team was little more than long hair, poor dress, and unprofessional attitudes. Obviously, this lady has a haunted house. In fact, their actions do more harm by not addressing her apparent plea for help. In a last-ditch attempt to help her, I came across, remember, this is a family doctor, folks, I came across another group located in Georgia who, from personal contacts, had a favorable reputation. The Georgia Paranormal Research Team made every effort to accommodate and assist her in every way imaginable. Both gentlemen, they're named, went on to suggest possible reasons with remedies for problems and continued to touch base with the family until everybody involved got relief. At no time did they ask for payment. In fact, according to others who've talked to them, their only request was for coffee to be available during the investigations. Now, I'm interested in following up on this story, Doctor. So if you want to put me in touch with the family, you obviously know how to email me. Put me in touch with the family, and I would very much love to interview them if they're up for it. Regarding the crash of the plane in New York, I've received an email that I'm just going to share with you. I have no way of knowing if what's being relayed to me here is accurate or not. You may want to comment on it. I will relate it without comment. Art, my wife's brother is a level 6 executive for American Airlines. That's a top level. He meets every few days with the CEO. Beth and I finally talked to him on the phone yesterday and asked him about the recent crash. I couldn't help it. I asked if he thought the crash was really due to turbulence, which is what they're saying, folks, caused by the plane ahead, 747, I believe, wide body, and if he knew anything. He paused for a really long time. Then he said, quote, "We don't really know anything except that no plane I know of has ever lost both engines and the tail for any reason. We're having to be very careful here what we say. I can't really discuss this any further. We're extremely close friends slash family." His guarded tone about all this was really, really unusual. Our son. All my life, folks, I have related a lot of what goes on in life here on Earth to the sun and the eruptions of the sun. And boy, it's going really nuts up there right now, folks. In fact, if you're a ham radio operator, 6 meters has been open in truly spectacular fashion. Here's an interesting Associated Press article, just part of it. The brightening and dimming of the sun may account for a 1,500-year cycle of cooling and warming on parts of the Earth. Researchers found that a very slight difference, very slight, in the amount of solar energy reaching the Earth can have a very powerful effect on the climate. Ice builds up in lands bordering the North Atlantic, the average temperature dropping in Europe and North America. So here we go. They're saying the sun has a really, really, really big effect on us. And as the climate changes, here's another one. From Scripps Howard News Service, The potential effects of climate change include everything from the sinking of tiny island nations to melting glaciers, and there's a big new one coming north, folks, big new glacier, to increasing weather extremes such as heat waves and flooding. And I didn't mean to say glacier. There's a big hunk of ice that, and I mean a giant one, they're still trying to assess how big, that's broken off at the bottom of the world and beginning to float this away. They've got more and more studies showing that global warming is probably one of the reasons that more people are sneezing. Now, how many of you out there, I've been having some sneezing fits lately. For me, most of my life, sneezing was always accompanied by a sore throat in the beginning of God help us a cold. But lately I've been just having sneezing fits, and I wonder if any of the rest of you have been experiencing this. I've never been given to allergies of any sort. Me, it's bad back. I don't have allergies. And so normally, indeed, if I would sneeze, it'd be a cold, and lately, the last year or so, I've been given to having sneezing fits that don't really mean anything other than you get stuffed up and sneeze for whatever reason. So, I don't know. That and asthma, way up. Ooh, check this out. Heat trapping, and again, this is the Associated Press, heat trapping carbon dioxide emissions jumped 3.1% in the U.S. last year, the biggest increase since the mid-1990s, according to the Energy Department. Carbon dioxide emissions in 2000 were nearly 14% higher than in 1990. Holy mackerel! Listen to that again. Carbon dioxide emissions in 2000 were nearly 14% higher than in 1990. Ay, 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 ay. So again, I tell you, our sun has a very great deal, in my opinion, to do with everything. We are human beings trolling about on the planet, and not a one of us is not affected by what goes on the sun. I have related sun activity to earthquakes, to climate change, and so we might want to look at what the sun is doing right now, because these, you must admit, are rather extreme times, aren't they? Pretty extreme out there in every way, right? Well, here comes the sun. This is tonight's report from NOAA, their NOAA weather, space weather forecast. And they simply say, active region 9704 has developed a delta-class magnetic field that harbors energy for powerful X-class explosions. So indeed, here comes the sun. The sun is getting very active in every aspect of... Listen to this one, Associated Press. Portland, Maine. The sea level has risen from 12 to 20 inches along Maine's coast and as much as 2 feet in Nova Scotia during the last 250 years. So I guess I'm painting a kind of a picture for you of what I think is going on with the sun. And I think it simply affects every aspect of our lives. In every way, your personality, your anger levels, your stress levels, your health, the planet's health, whether we have earthquakes, frequent earthquakes, all of this I relate to the sun and a whole lot more. Climate change, it acts in every way on us, so monitoring what's going on in the sun is a really good idea. And I do a lot of that on this program for exactly that reason. In a moment, I will tell you about an acquaintance of Stephen Gibbs, the man who made the time machine. Do you remember Stephen Gibbs, the time machine that I have that I still haven't tried yet? Too chicken? I have met a man who has modified a Stephen Gibbs time machine for his own purposes, and it is fascinating. Just wait till you see what this man has done. Actually, it's on my website right now. If you go to my website, artbell.com, and look under what's new, first item is Spiritual Traveler Meditation Chair. And more that I don't want to talk about on the air, and he doesn't really either. This man has taken the Stephen Gibbs time machine and turned it into something truly incredible. I mean, what he has built is amazing. And he's got detailed photographs of what he has built. And, of course, the Stephen Gibbs time machine, you'll see it there. Along with something about the modifications the man has made. Anyway, I will tell you more about that in a moment. Right now, suffice it to say that if you go to my website, you can begin looking at the photographs that I'm about to mention. All right, we are going to be doing open lines for the remainder of this this hour. And then next hour, oh my, brace yourself next hour. I told you that the minute we had information on this incredible story in Cuba, we'd break it to you. Tonight, we have breaking news on the Cuban story. Linda Moulton Howe is going to be here. Well, what am I talking about? There has been found what appears to be an ancient city 2,200 feet below sea level off the coast of Cuba. Do you understand the implications of that? Even the last ice age could only have accounted for a change in sea level of about 300 feet. 300 feet in the last ice age. And here we're talking about, oh God, this incredible find off Cuba. National Geographic is investigating, and it appears there is a city with roads and buildings and pyramids and you name it, 2,200 feet below sea level off the coast of Cuba. Now, even I don't have all the information. Linda was so excited earlier today that she was telling me about it. I said, Linda, I want to hear about it the same time everybody else does. Now, I know a couple of things, but the majority of it I've not heard either, so I'll be hearing it with you tonight. But Linda actually got an interview, folks. She got an interview with Paulina Zelitsky, the lady who found all of this. It's going to be absolutely fascinating. And it's big, big news. Now, obviously, one possibility, you know, that we've talked about with people is the possibility that what's below the sea off that coast is part of Atlantis. The almost mythical Atlantis. Could there have been a land one time occupying portions of the sea that literally sank for whatever mystical, crazy reason? It just sank. And I presume that everybody died. It must have happened very quickly, and nobody can imagine what would have caused it. Oh, I suppose people can imagine what might have caused it, but they don't really know. And it's almost a myth. Is there really an Atlantis? Many, many, many of my guests say there is indeed Atlantis. And so they'll not be surprised. But you sure will. When you hear Linda's report tonight, it's gonna set you back on your heels. She has a very dry, interesting way of reporting. And actually, in that manner, understates everything. Believe me, what you're gonna hear tonight cannot be overstated. I'm Art Bell. This is Coast to Coast AM.
Happy and I'm smiling, walking miles to drink your water. You know I love to love you and about you.
This is Coast to Coast with Art Bell. The WPRO Morning News, bright and early, starting at 5. It's everything you need to start the day on AM 630, WPRO. southern New England depends on WPRO's exclusive AccuWeather forecast.
Increasing clouds, windy overnight, low near 50. Tuesday, windy, a few showers, high 52. Windy and cold Tuesday night with clearing, lows 26 to 30. Wednesday, partly sunny, high 44. With WPRO's exclusive AccuWeather, I'm Reggie Lutz.
You can depend on AccuWeather at News Talk Radio 630. WPRO.
About 30,000 Taliban fighters remain surrounded by Northern Alliance troops at Kunduz. In return for leaving the city, the Taliban are demanding safe passage to a third country. Meanwhile, the situation in Kandahar continues to worsen. Here's the BBC's Peter Grista.
The pressure is still on in Kandahar, where civilians have been struggling to carry on amid the attacks. The Taliban insist they are still in control of the city and that life is continuing as normally as possible. But conditions are said to be deteriorating and internally displaced people have been forced to live where they can.
That's the BBC's Peter Grista in Kabul, Afghanistan. FBI officials say they believe the same person sent a suspected anthrax letter to Senator Patrick Leahy and last month's anthrax letter to Senator Tom Daschle. Postal investigators are also trying to figure out if it was misdirected through the State Department's mail. I'm Dorothy McIntyre, ABC News.
He's been reporting the news to the world for over 50 years through 10 presidential administrations. He's Paul Harvey. And he's heard three times daily on WPRO. Paul Harvey was reporting the news when Dan Rather was in diapers. A great American belongs on a great radio station. Hear Paul Harvey three times daily, mornings at 8:30. Middays at 11:45, and the rest of the story, nights at 7:05, on News Talk Radio 630, WPRO.
Good day.
You know how when you're ready to buy something, there's always a little voice of doubt that keeps whispering in your ear. It's leaving you feeling like you're not really sure whether you're getting a good deal or not. Well, listen closely to this little voice. Nationwide Home Improvement is offering the greatest sunroom you can imagine. Nationwide Custom Sunrooms offer thermal insulated roof and walls, plus energy efficient high tempered glass, which means year-round enjoyment with no bugs, no wind, no rain or snow, and the most comprehensive lifetime warranty available. This means you enjoy a maintenance-free sunroom that's virtually impervious to the elements. Plus, for a limited time, purchase a Nationwide sunroom and receive a free spa or complete set of quality sunroom furniture. Installation time is so quick that you'll enjoy sitting or soaking in your new living space in a matter of days. Call 722-8100 now before they change their minds. Call 722-8100. 722-8100. Nationwide Home Improvement, because home is where your heart is.
Mom, I'm home. When's dinner?
Not for a little while. Fix yourself a snack.
Last year, Jared's father injured his back.
Mom, there's no cookies.
Shh, Jared, stop shouting. Your father's asleep. Have some crackers.
It's taking a lot longer than anyone expected for him to recover.
There are no crackers.
Then have some fruit, honey.
It's also taking a lot more prescriptions.
It's all gone.
Let me see.
Prescriptions so expensive, they're having side effects on the whole family.
Can't you wait till dinner?
But I'm hungry.
This is Joe Kennedy. If prescriptions are costing you too much, call 1-800-JOE-K4RX. That's 1-800-563-5479. For a small fee, you'll receive a Citizens Health membership card that can save you money. And it's accepted at most pharmacies. Call 1-800-JOE-K4RX today. Citizens Health. Less for prescriptions, more for life. From Citizens Energy, a nonprofit company.
This is Coast to Coast with Art Bell. Mega Ocean State Dittos. Rush Limbaugh, noon till 3 on News Talk Radio 630, WPRO.
I got music in me.
Kingdom of Nye. From west of the Rockies, dial 1-800-618-8255. East of the Rockies, 1-800-825-5033. First-time callers may reach Art at 1-775-727-1222. Or use the wildcard line at 1-775-727-1295. To reach Art on the toll-free international line, call your AT&T operator and have them dial 800-893-0903. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell on the Premier Radio Network.
Ah, that would be us. Good morning, everybody, from Pahrump in the high desert. I'm Art Bell. It's great to be here. We're about to go to open lines, and anything that's on your mind is fair game, but I do want you to go to my website and see the, under What's News, Spiritual Traveler Meditation Chair, and you'll see a modified Stephen Gibbs time machine. And when I say modified, I mean really heavily modified, to do some other things as well as time travel. It really makes some interesting claims, some of which can't even be discussed on the air. I don't know if I'd try this or not, but this man has really taken the Gibbs time travel machine and taken it to a new level altogether. You've got to see it. It's on my website, as I mentioned. First item under What's New right now. In a moment, open line. You know what I've been wondering about? If a city can suddenly, if continents can suddenly sink beneath the water and down to 2,200 feet, God knows how it would get down to 2,200 feet, but if that happened once, then it can happen twice. And maybe it's just a big cycle here on Earth. Maybe it's connected to the actions of the sun. And so, investigating whether, you know, it's interesting enough, obviously, whether it's Atlantis below the sea, is interesting all by itself. But once you realize that, oh, gee, that is Atlantis, then you've got to imagine that it could happen again to another continent, or two or three. And maybe it does happen cyclically. Something to, think about. First-time caller line, you're on the air. Hello.
Hi, Art. I really enjoy your show. Thank you for having me on.
Thank you. Where are you?
I'm Phoenix, Arizona. My name is Matthew.
Okay.
I've been doing some intuitive research, and I've come to the understanding that the sun is the propagating force behind all motion, up to and including neurotransmissions.
It's propagating everything, you're saying?
Absolutely everything,
yeah,
that has to do with motion from the very beginning of our solar system to any time we could ever conceive in the future.
Well, it is the source of all energy, ultimately, when you think about it. I mean, all energy is supported by the sun. And if it were not for the sun, other than some geologic energy that might be associated with the movement of planets and planetary bodies near each other, other than that, the sun is probably every aspect of our life, more than people understand.
Exactly, and I've seen these photos. There's a real famous photo that I've just witnessed, and it's a picture of the Earth from like 4 million miles out, or
yes,
something to that extent.
Yes.
And it's this little pebble. And there's this huge ray that covers it. And it's they say that it's the a solar ray. And looking at that photo, I think of the sun as like a parent, and we're like this little garden.
It's children.
You know, cultivating.
yes indeed. But like any garden, there can be an overnight freeze. What am I laughing about? There can be an overnight change in your garden. It's all the weather. And the weather is also controlled by the sun. Increasing evidence. So the sun controls everything. You mentioned seeing the Earth from 4 million miles out, little dot, right? To put it in perspective, as you traveled in space, the Earth would disappear very, very quickly. We are an insignificant, barely viewable speck from any serious space distance at all. There's much bigger, brighter stuff going on out there than ourselves. Also something you might keep in mind. Wildcard line, you're on the air. Good morning.
Yes, good evening, Art. This is John in Scottsdale. Welcome back, my friend, to the show that must never end.
Thank you, John.
With apologies to Emerson, Lincoln, Palmer. Couple things on my mind this evening. I have a 16-year-old son who, like myself, has taken a great interest in a lot of the subjects that are discussed in the show.
Mm-hmm.
And he was wondering if this time machine that's being developed by the person who's featured on your website is something like the external Merkaba mentioned in some of Bob Frisell's works, which he kind of likes, that there's a danger in doing things externally or mechanically that should be done internally, should be done with the mind alone.
Well, that's kind of like what they say about drugs, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah, the shortcut is the shortcut to nowhere.
Yeah, I'm with you, and I think I would be personally hesitant, as I have been, to use Mr. Gibbs' time machine or to use the highly modified chair that you see depicted on my website tonight. I don't think I'd do it. However, one thing you can say about drugs would be, and of course it can be argued, but they do take you into a very different place. Psychedelic drugs, for example.
Yeah, it's a jolt to let you know something's there, but beyond that, it's a killer. So
it's dangerous. Yes,
extremely so.
And that might be exactly the parallel to this. I agree with you. I agree with you.
The other thing that was we were wondering is, first of all, has there been any follow-up or any more information regarding the Chilbolton glyphs, which, of course, were erased from the public consciousness as soon as, 9/11 happened?
Rest assured, my friend, I will ask Linda tonight about Chilbolton.
I appreciate that very much.
What do you think we're going to hear tonight about Cuba? Any guess?
Well, I think that what this is, there's a book out, Atlantis in America, by the co-authors Ivar Zapp and George Erickson,
mm-hmm.
who talk about the fact that there's a hell of a lot of ruins in the New World that actually antedate or predate ruins in the Old World, that the Central American area was pretty much the center of this major civilization. The ocean currents served as a sort of a conveyor belt carrying them everywhere in the world. And basically what I think is that you're just going to have to push the timeline of civilization way, way back from what was previously thought. And it was very gratifying, in fact, to hear the news the other day, or yesterday, I think it was, about the Cairo find, the Egyptian artifacts in the underground cavern in southern Illinois.
Yes, and Zahi Hawass in Egypt is making more big discoveries.
Oh, he must
right
be
now.
Jumping up and down about this.
Well, he is.
He doesn't want this to happen.
I appreciate the call, sir. Thank
Take
you.
Care.
Take care. Listen, it's entirely possible that what we view as human history is total baloney. A lot of forbidden archaeology and a lot of evidence exists that we may have been here far, far longer than we imagine. That civilizations may have come and gone and virtually been washed away by sufficient time. Or maybe I should say almost washed away. Almost obliterated, but there are those who see signs, and there are also those who reject those signs and that evidence. And they sort of put it up on the shelf and just, they say, well, it can't be. It doesn't fit our model, so out you go. We don't believe you. We don't want to hear about you. And we write papers, and we don't want our papers challenged. East of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hello.
Hello, Art. This is Mike from Cleveland.
Yes, Mike. How's Cleveland this morning?
It's getting over the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
It's going down to 30s. Just got over a warming trend.
Mm, winter cometh.
Oh, yeah. I'm all prepared for it. Got my boots, my snowsuit, the whole 9 yards, Art.
That's not how we prepare for it here.
Oh, it could have been out there in the desert.
Yeah. Here, daytimes in the winter are about 70. 65, 70 degrees, typically.
And in the evening?
Oh, it gets cold as hell. The minute the sun goes down, it gets cold.
Oh.
Anyway, what's up?
How serious is global warming? Can most of the places like Antarctica and Iceland melt in thousands of years of going over your head?
Oh, the answer to your question is global warming is, in my opinion, very, very serious. And I don't want to get into a war, and I'll get emails, I know, about, oh, we're so tired, we don't want to hear about global war. It's the truth. Whether you want to talk about ocean levels, air temperatures, everything that that goes with the climate change we are experiencing, it is not just forecast to happen, it is happening now. And I don't care whether you believe it's a natural cyclical event or the hand of man is hurrying it along. I don't care. Fact is, it is obviously without argument occurring. Well, there could be some argument, but I personally don't see it. Personally, I see extremely strong evidence that it is occurring right now. Now, where is it going? Oh, that's a really good question. What kind of mountain or valley are we headed toward? I don't know. That's a really good question. Are we about to be 2,200 feet down? Hope not. But you never know. West of the Rockies, you are on the air. Good morning.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Where are you?
I'm in Portland, Oregon.
And your first name?
Jennifer.
Jennifer, okay.
And I wanted to say welcome back.
Thank you.
I just heard about your show a little while ago, and I've been waiting for you to come back so I could call and ask you about a question about shadow people.
Okay.
Have you ever heard of them attacking somebody?
Yes.
Okay, because...
In fact, we have photographs of it occurring.
Okay, because I've seen shadow people all my life, and when I became maybe about 16, 17, I started having... Whenever I would see them, I would have nightmares, and I would wake up with bruises all over my legs.
Oh, that's more than nightmares, isn't it?
Yeah, and I've just been...
Do you recall being attacked?
In my dreams, I do.
Well, obviously, they were more than dreams with
right.
the, you know, black and blue marks. What kind of attacks were they?
Usually, they're just physical attacks, somebody trying to hurt me.
I mean, just beating you up, punching you, kicking you, what?
Just kicking at me, grabbing my legs. I'm always trying to run away. One time I woke up and I had what looked like fingerprints on my leg, and I thought maybe, you know, for a long time I thought I was just doing this to myself or something in my sleep, but
yes.
I tried to space my fingers out to make it fit, and it didn't fit the handprint. And I don't know, I guess I've always just thought I was like, I've never heard of anything like this.
And surely if... What about your situation at home? I don't know whether you're married or...
No, I live by myself.
Oh, you live by yourself?
Yeah.
Oh, well, that just removes one great possibility that I was about to jump on. Glad I didn't have to. You live by yourself? Oh, my God.
Yeah, and usually this happens when I'm by myself. And actually, the really weird thing is when I'm around other people, if like a friend spends the night or something, usually I don't... have the nightmares, but one time I had a very receptive friend. She was very receptive to spiritual things, and when she woke up in the morning and she went to the bathroom, I looked at her legs, and she was telling me she had this horrible nightmare, and she had bruises all over her legs. And ever since then, I haven't let her spend the night at my house.
Have you seen these beings? I would presume so.
In the shadows, yes.
Yes.
I see them all the time. It's actually really pretty much one being, not really a whole bunch.
What have you done about this?
Well, for my sleep, I've protected it. I'm into paganism, and so I'm into crystals and you know, protection spells. And I have some crystals by my bed, and that actually really helps. I haven't had any attacks since then.
You don't think the crystals and the paganism are what's bringing it on? I speak to you as some of the Christian audience out there is saying, I know why she's being attacked.
I understand that, but it's actually something that went on long before I discovered paganism, and that actually is the only thing I've ever found that could have really helped.
How many years has this been going on?
Well, I've seen shadow people all my life.
But the attacks?
The attacks happened. They started probably when I was about 15 or 16 years old.
And you are now?
I'm now 25.
25?
Yeah.
Have you sought help from anybody?
I don't know where to look. I've tried to talk to my friends about it, and nobody seems to understand it. Nobody's heard of anything.
I can only imagine what that would be like, you know, getting attacked in your sleep and waking up with terrible bruises and...
Now you can see why I waited so long to call you.
Yes, I can.
Get a hold of you.
I certainly can. How frequently does this occur?
Usually it happens if I don't have... The protection I have right now, which hasn't happened for a long time, but it used to happen, it would taper off and nothing would happen for a while, and then it would be a whole bunch, like, you know, bam, 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 a couple of times a week. And then it would just taper off for a few months, and it would just come in the waves.
And it last happened how long ago?
Oh, it was probably about 6 or 7 months ago.
Well, that's getting better.
Yeah, I'm okay. I'm dealing with this, with what happens. I just am wanting to know if, you know, what's going on and if I'm crazy and, you know, what it could be, because I want some kind of an explanation.
You know what I'd love to do? If you ever get the opportunity, don't do this because it could be dangerous, but, you know, if you ever get into a period where you're getting attacked frequently, set up a video camera.
Okay.
And let it, just tape you while you're asleep.
Okay.
Think you could do that?
I could probably do that.
I really, really would appreciate it, and you contact me privately by email, all right?
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Take care. That would certainly be interesting, wouldn't it? I've had a lot of reports of this kind of thing, people being attacked by something. Now, how does it register to listen to what that young lady just had to say? She'd been attacked for years and years now. Physical bruising, serious physical bruising, and she lives alone. First time caller line, you're on the air, good morning.
Hey, Art Bell.
Yes, sir.
Hey, sir. Hi, my name is Wayne.
Where are you, Wayne?
I'm in Anchorage, Alaska.
Anchorage, and a first-time caller at that.
Absolutely.
Okay, welcome.
Welcome to you. Thank you. Welcome back. Hey, you used to do something. I can only call it rapid-fire radio. You had a specific name for it. I can't remember what it was.
Yeah, we called it Fast Blast. That's where the whole Fast Blast thing came from.
Oh, okay. Have you done it on the radio lately?
No, and, you know, we'll do it one night. Would you like to?
Yeah, I would, absolutely. It's been a long, like 5 years or more since I heard it last season.
Yeah, it's just a thing where we, for 1 hour or half hour or whatever it is, we let people go on the air in rapid-fire fashion and say one sentence.
Yeah, exactly.
One sentence, or at least one extremely short paragraph and no more. Usually one sentence, and it is very, very, very interesting. Yeah, we'll do it one night.
It is great.
We'll do it.
Perfect.
All right.
Thanks, sir.
Right, thank you. Wildcard Line, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hi, Art. This is Chris in Minnesota. How are you?
I'm fine, Chris. Better than I've been in a long time. Standing up straight, for me, it's a miracle.
Oh, well, that's great. We're really happy to have you back on the air.
Thank you.
I had two things for you. I was wondering, do you think this business about the sun is what's causing the climate change, or do you think it's man... action?
I think that it's primarily the sun. It's primarily a cyclical thing. But I think the hand of man may well tip the balance toward a more serious peak or valley, if you follow what I'm saying. In other words, we have something to do with it.
I do, and I tend to agree with that. The other thing is, I remember, you know, a couple of, well, 6 or 7 weeks ago, you had Ed Gaines on, you know, making his predictions, you know, about the future terrorist attacks.
Yes.
And he was supposed to keep us all, you know, informed about what they were doing with remote viewing. Have you talked with Ed, and has he remote viewed the anthrax scares, and when do you think he might be on again?
We will have Ed on again shortly. That's all I can tell you. We'll have him on again shortly, all right?
Well, that's great. Thanks a lot, Art. Great to have you back.
All right, thank you. And you can't imagine how good it feels to get back. Coming up in a moment is Linda Moulton Howe with breaking news. I repeat, breaking news on Cuba. You're going to want to drop everything you're doing, whatever it is you're doing. Turn your radio up and pay close attention to what's coming up. Right now, I'm going to go away. I'm Art Bell, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Roaring through the nighttime, once again, with me, Art Bell. She has been an investigator for many, many years on this program, as well as Dreamland, and she is she's impeccable. Her reports are absolutely impeccable. Here tonight's guest, and she is the guest for this evening, is Linda Moulton Howe. First on the agenda tonight is Cuba. Linda, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Art. Well, I wanted to know if you got to see the Leonid meteor shower Saturday to Sunday.
You betcha. My wife and I, of course, in Pahrump, Nevada, the skies are relatively dark compared to the rest of the world in the middle of the desert and clear with low humidity, and it was a perfectly clear night. Oh, Linda, it was incredible. It was incredible.
Same here. It was crystal clear. There wasn't a cloud. And at one point, between 4 and 5, I was counting at least 80 to 90 in the hour. And at one point, there were 5 trails all in the sky at the same time, followed by whoosh, 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 whoosh.
Oh, right.
Never seen anything like it.
Linda, it was so bright. Some of them were so bright here that you could see your shadow.
Oh, they were just, exploding. I thought it was amazing. And these Leonids are the rocks and dust left over from the Temple Tuttle comet that orbits the sun. And comets and meteors have a surprising connection to this news update tonight about Cuba.
No
and,
kidding. Now, yeah. Folks, I have not heard this yet. I refuse to let Linda tell me about it earlier today. So.
We will get into this.
Okay.
Okay. Now, first, to set the stage, the story about a possible megalithic site half a mile down off the western tip of Cuba first broke this past May when a Reuters News Service reporter interviewed the deep ocean engineer who first reported unusual side-scan sonar of the discovery. Her name is Paulina Zielitzki. Mrs. Zielitzki was born in Poland, studied engineering in the Soviet Union, was assigned to work on a secret submarine base in Cuba during the Cold War, and eventually defected to Canada. There she met her current husband, businessman Paul Weinzweig. Now the couple own and operate a company called Advanced Digital Communications, or ADC, with offices in both Victoria, British Columbia, and Havana, Cuba. Their specialty is deep ocean exploration. ADC made news in November 2000 when Paulina Zielitzki found the wreckage of the famous USS Maine that blew up and sank in 1898.
That's something we found out about her later. I remember getting this story and sending it to you, Linda, and, you know, I've done that with a lot of stories that turned out to be nothing. But this one, oh, man. Yeah, you talked to Paulina Zielitzki, and it was suddenly something.
Oh, absolutely. And it was a mysterious sinking, that USS Maine. It was 3 miles off the Havana coast and 2/3 of a mile down, and she got down there with a team, videotaped the battleship, which matched the old photographs. And now this year, Paulina Zielitzki reports that about 2,200 feet below Cuba's western tip, she has found, quote, a huge land plateau with clear images of what appears to be man-made, large-sized architectural designs partly covered by sand. From above, the shapes resemble pyramids, roads, and buildings, unquote. This week, I talked with both Paulina Zielitzki and Paul Weinzweig and learned that in addition to the sonar images this late summer, they were able to get a videotape camera and lights down for a preliminary view in the underwater site with a robotic ocean vehicle known as an ROV.
So these are actual cameras?
Yeah, they actually have some preliminary videotape, and over the past several months,
everybody should know how important this story is because everybody shut their mouth. As you investigated, we found out National Geographic was looking into it and had an ongoing project, and they shut their mouths. Boy, they wouldn't tell us a thing.
Everybody has been very quiet.
Paulina Zielitzki wouldn't say anything.
Right, and I've had an agreement with Mr. Weinzweig, her husband, in which I can discuss their progress with the site, but will only report publicly when I have their permission. And now is a portion of our most recent discussion this past week on the record for broadcast, and it includes the surprise of Paulina Zielitzki joining this interview.
Wow. Okay.
Is there any thing that you can say on the record for radio this morning that I could do some kind of an update?
For the record, you can say that the Center for marine archaeology and anthropology at the Cuban Academy of Sciences, is currently analyzing video data which we have from the perimeter of the site, from megalithic stones. They're working on inscriptions that they have detected on these stones, and they are analyzing them at this time.
And what are the estimated sizes of these stones?
The estimated sizes of these stones, they're roughly, they could be roughly about 2 by 5 meters.
2 by 5?
Very large stones.
And,
That's about 6 feet by 15 feet, 16 feet, something like that.
And you mentioned possibly the same kind of look as the perimeter stones at Stonehenge, that kind of looking rectangular?
Yeah, the same kind of stone that you see in Easter Island, in Stonehenge, very large and smooth and light-colored, that bear no, as I say, bear no relationship to the surrounding ecology, and also there's evidence of smooth cut and fit.
Smooth cut and fit.
That is one on top of another. You know, as if it were a basis of a pyramid or a large building.
And those stones, where are the possible inscriptions? Up, you know, like top or bottom or middle or.
Well, they're not anywhere specific on the stones. These inscriptions, it could be in the middle of the stones, in various parts of the stones, across. One thing we found, the anthropologist found, was an American a cross. It's a Central American cross.
Is that where two lines are crossed? Perpendicular to each other with anything special on the ends, or
no? They're not two lines. They're two oval shapes crossing each other. Yeah.
Two sort of long ovals crossing each other the way a cross crosses.
Yeah, like a cross crosses, not a single line. It's a flattened circle.
Did these, so far, from what you've seen on the video, do they seem to be inscribed into the stone like a quarter of an inch or a half an inch, or do you have any sense of how deep?
I can't tell, really. Limited lighting and limited perspective as well because of the. We had technical problems with the ROV that we couldn't.
It's really dark at a half mile down, isn't it?
Well, there's no light at all.
Yeah.
Except what we provided.
And so that's, you're limited in only what you can get in that light in front of you. And
well, that's okay. We have good lighting now, and we have a low light camera to add to our two or three other cameras that we have there as well. To our zoom camera, we have several cameras. Work down there, and we have good lighting, so there's no reason. There was a lot of debris in the water at that time, created by a strong current, probably plankton. So.
When do you think you're going to be able to go down with all the cameras and everything functioning?
Well, hopefully, if we get all our systems back together again. Within the next 2 months, and we get a break in the weather.
And the museum that's doing, analyze these carved inscriptions on the stones you've seen so far, have you had any indication that they think it matches any known ancient script?
No, we don't have any conclusions yet. They're still in process. The analysis is still in process.
Have they made any comment about them? The symbols or the carvings?
Greek-like inscriptions.
Greek-like?
Well, not hieroglyphic-type inscriptions.
Hieroglyphic meaning sort of like Egypt.
I said the lettering is Greek-like.
Okay, the lettering is Greek-like, but there's also...
Hold on, just a minute. Just a minute. Why don't you talk to my boss?
Oh, okay. I'd love to. Thank you.
Oh, my.
Her name is Polina Zelitsky.
All right.
Hi, Linda.
Hello. I'm so happy to meet you on the phone.
Yes, thank you. I was overhearing my husband. And I don't want you to make any bad mistakes like saying Greek, okay?
All right.
Because it's not Greek. It has the same tendency in lion, but it's not Greek.
Hmm.
We don't know what it is. Academy of Sciences are deciphering.
Right. It has some resemblances in lettering to Greek, but it is not Greek.
Mm-hmm.
It is not Greek. And there are some, like pictographs that would fall into the hieroglyphic category as well.
Yes, and symbology as well. There are different signs, more like of American nature. You know, similar signs that they found in Central America on pyramids
and
delineation of the structures also suggests pyramidal type or American pyramidal type, not Egyptian pyramidal type.
Okay, and you mean by the glyphic symbols that would be found in Mesoamerican pyramids?
Mm-hmm.
And that's where that cross that's made of ovals crossing each other, that would be an example?
That's an example. That's correct. And this type of cross is called American cross. And we find it out in Cuba in a variety of caves all around the island. They're very ancient. They're pre-Columbian, thousands of years before Columbus.
And so those,
as you know, Cuba has submerged 3 times.
Cuba
in the history of formation of island.
Okay, so Cuba has gone under the water 3 times?
Yes.
And in caves underwater around the island, the American cross has been found carved in
Yes, and other symbology, other cosmic type depiction, yes. And you find it in Cuban caves around the island, really, not only in the south, but also in the north.
And
those caves are underwater caves, yes. And just one cave I know of in Isle of Youth is on land that has this type of symbology as well.
And when archaeologists have studied the carvings in the caves in Cuba, have they been able to match those symbols and those glyphs to any other pre-existing known language?
They're trying to match it to Central American. But each is distinctive on its own, right? It's very difficult to say that Central American ancient symbology is identical to this. It's not identical. It's similar, but not identical.
Now, after hearing about the symbol of crossed ovals and mysterious lettering, I began my own search. I called the Archaeology and Anthropology Department at the University of Pennsylvania, which has one of the finest collections of Olmec, Mayan, and other Mesoamerican artifacts of the world. And this weekend, I spent several hours searching the library's rare books of Mayan and Mesoamerican glyphs, and I could not find a single cross of ovals until I opened up a book called The Language of the Sea Peoples. There, in a section comparing hieroglyphs from the Minoan island of Crete with hieroglyphs known as Linear Sea Language used by an ancient Minoan culture called Luvian, I found it. You can see the symbol in its Linear Sea context right from the book at my website, www.earthfiles.com.
We've got a link up right now.
Go to the headlines page and scroll down to the top story. And there you will also see some photographs that Polina Zelitsky sent me. Now, I also found a more complicated crossed oval symbol in Assyrian hieroglyphics. That's there. And I sent both of those symbols to Paulina Zielitzky for comment, and she emailed back two color photographs that she had taken inside a Cuban cave that included yet a different cross symbol, which you can see in my EarthFiles.com report. She said that her photographs are from Cuban caves that scientific community people believe belong to what they call the Sea People. Now, how would an ancient Minoan symbol end up a half mile down amid other apparent megalithic structures off the western tip of Cuba? I took that question to the editor-in-chief of Ancient American magazine, Frank Joseph. Frank has studied the end of the Bronze Age around 1200 BC, which is 3,200 years ago. And after we come back from this upcoming break, Art, we will learn why he thinks that the Oval Cross could link to Atlantis and astonishing new scientific evidence that a global catastrophe did happen in 1200 BC.
Oh, man, here we go. All right. Oh, my God, what a story, Linda. All right, stay right there. So, Greek-like hieroglyphics, underwater, inscriptions underwater on this stuff we've been talking about. They've got it with cameras. That's the big news. We'll be right back. This is such a big story that Linda should know that the Earth Files website, according to everybody fast-blasting me, is down.
Really?
And so maybe you could, well, yeah, it's getting slammed, Linda. So maybe you could explain to everybody roughly what the symbols look like. Can you give a graphic description?
Yes. Think of a oval that is narrow.
Okay.
And you've put one on the vertical axis, and you put an identical oval on the horizontal axis the way you would a cross, except these are crossing ovals.
Wow, okay.
And exactly that is a symbol in the Luwian Linear C language, a very, very unusual. Linear C is very rare, and apparently those people were antecedents in Minoan Crete, and you're going to hear a lot more about this.
Okay, we don't know what it means, do we?
You're going to hear some speculation, perhaps,
okay,
from Frank Joseph, because he has been editing Ancient American magazine for some time, doing tremendous amounts of research for 21 years into the Bronze Age, and he has authored a 1998 book entitled Atlantis in Wisconsin. That is a whole other sub-bar story, and you will hear him discuss a part of that in time that we're going to go forward. And in another new book about to be released, he has gone into the Edgar Cayce work. The title of this new book that will be in bookstores the 1st of December is Edgar Cayce's Atlantis in Lemuria. And a third book that he will release in 2002 is called The Destruction of Atlantis. Frank has devoted more than two decades to studying physical evidence of a global Atlantean culture which he believes was destroyed in a worldwide catastrophe in 1200 B.C. And in his September to October issue of Ancient American magazine, there is a brief article entitled U.S. Navy Atlantis Cover-Up? It says that on September 7th this year, a team from Spain and the United States looking for oil were, quote, 250 miles southwest of the Azores, equipped with a bathyscaphe and two submersibles, reaching a 90-kilometer ledge with a central temple supported by three stands of nine pillars about 3 feet in diameter, supporting a flat stone roof about 20 feet wide and 30 feet long. Quoting from this report, there are the remains of 5 circular canals and bridges, plus 4 rings of structures like the temple in between. This is roughly 2,800 feet deep in the Mid-Atlantic Trench and is stable at this time, unquote. Frank Joseph and I are still trying to confirm this report, but that depth of 2,800 feet is around the half-mile depth in the Cuban site. And this weekend, I asked Frank about the crossed oval symbol in the Linear C language of Diluvian.
All right, here we go.
The Diluvians were people who lived, who were about the same as the Trojans. They lived on what is now Turkey. They were either an ally of the Trojans, a close ally during the Trojan War and before, or else they were in fact Trojans. Some Diluvian script supposedly has been found in Italy, and they think that that is an important link between the Etruscans and Asia Minor, or what is now Turkey. And the Diluvians were maritime people,
mm-hmm.
very proficient at sea.
And this crossed oval symbol of theirs, related to what is lettered as LU, also goes across in all of the columns in comparison to the other languages where the symbols appears to mean star.
A star, yeah, but that LU that's repeated, that's like they're identifying themselves, that, you know, this is the Diluvians, the VNs, that's
mm-hmm.
just an English convenience, but they might probably call themselves like the Lou if you were to pronounce it
mm-hmm.
in their language. So it's very, very interesting. Whole cultural context is Atlantean, because the Atlanteans were plugged into the Trojans. The Trojans themselves had a story of Atlantis. Their founder was Dardanus, who came from an Atlantis, Electra, when she was sinking into the sea. This is very complex, highly thinly woven stuff, you know.
Well, can you please share this story from the Trojan point of view about Atlantis?
Trojans were a people who built their city around 3000 B.C., they chose that spot the Dardanelles because it was a very valuable place for trade between the East and the West. You had access then to the Black Sea. Whoever controlled the Dardanelles could control trade, and so Troy over time became a very wealthy city. And the story of the myth of Dardanus is that he was born on an island far away to the west, and his mother was Electra, E-L-E-K-T-R-A, Electra. Her father was Atlas, the name of the island that Atlantis was on. She was the daughter of Atlas, and her mother was Cleone. This is getting really...
Well, this is very similar to what Plato talks about.
And Cleone was the sea goddess who produced what is known as the Pleiades. And Pleiade means daughter of Atlas, which is Atlantis. That's what Atlantis means.
Pleiades means daughter of Atlas?
Pleiades means daughter of Atlas.
Wow.
It is a poetic way of saying that this is on Atlantis. Now,
the fact that there could have been an Atlantis that had bases that spread all the way from west of the Straits of Gibraltar that might include the Azores, the Canary Islands, across the Atlantic, is what begins to emerge as
absolutely
a greater truth than one single island.
Right. Now, the relationship between Atlantis and Troy is not the same as the relationship between, say, Atlantis and Yucatan, for
mm-hmm.
example, where they had an allied kingdom. I mean, they really owned Yucatan, or they would own parts of Ireland and Spain. That was really plugged in tight to the Atlantean Empire.
How far back would you put this, since Plato says, going through Solon and in the Critias, mm-hmm. 9,000 years prior to their discussion, and that would place it at about 11,500, wouldn't it?
No, that's another story altogether, but my colleagues and I have worked very hard and since the 1980s on the subject of the dates, and those dates are a mistake, that was a mistake in translation. The Greeks used a calendar very similar to ours. They used a solar calendar of about 365 days. This is a standard solar calendar. The Egyptians used a minimum of 5 different calendars, and including the solar calendar. Their priests and their holy places where they had the story of Atlantis, which was at a holy place called the Temple of Knife, Sais in Egypt, they used a lunar calendar. We conclude, after all this, that the priest at Sais, when he said 9,000 years, he is talking about lunar years and not solar years. There is abundant evidence to show that's exactly what he was saying. And the Greeks, when they heard this, they thought, oh, years. They're thinking solar years. And so when Plato is, all of the numerical values in the Critias and the Timaeus, especially the Critias, are totally inflated beyond reality. They do not work with the description that Plato gives. Plato describes a late Bronze Age citadel or city. There was a huge gap in knowledge between Plato's and Solon's time and what happened in Atlantis, because we now know that when the Bronze Age stopped suddenly around 1200 BC, that for the next 400 years at least, there was a period of profound dark age. There was no more writing. There was no more building of cities. The population of the world had decreased phenomenally. There was widespread burning. The entire Black Forest of Germany was incinerated. Every known archaeological site in the Near East and Asia Minor were burned. It is now understood that there was a major catastrophe, of which Atlantis was only a small part, that whipped around the world in a band, literally from about Iceland to, the middle of North Africa. That whipped around the world. It affected North America. It went right through the Pacific. There was a symposium of archaeoastronomers back in 1997, not New Age people at all, in England, in which they found that there was certainly the greatest natural catastrophe human beings ever witnessed around 1200 BC. And that was when two or more comets, including Halley's Comet, converged in the skies over Earth and showered the world with a barrage of asteroids and meteors that pushed human beings to the brink of extinction. And Atlantis was especially hard hit because there are two Swedish physicists, Larsson and Franzen, who established in 1997 that several asteroids, now I'm talking about meteorites, several asteroids collided in the eastern Atlantic, precisely in the location of Atlantis. And that is why we can explain why an island the size of Atlantis, which was 6,000 square miles,
mm-hmm.
it was not a continent, but it was a big island, but it was destroyed. I mean, if you have an island out in the middle of the water and it's hit by several nuclear blasts at once, the chances of that thing being around are slim.
What you mean is that the impact of these breaking or colliding asteroids would have been equivalent to atomic bomb forces hitting on the island.
Probably H-bomb forces.
Yeah.
And they didn't even have to hit the island. The island itself was part of the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, which is a very unstable area of the planet geologically. you could have an asteroid collision hundreds of miles away, but if it hit the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, that's the end of that island.
So the brief article that you have in the September-October issue of Ancient American about a Spanish oil research group being in the Azores and finding down 2,800 feet nine columns supporting some kind of a stone slab roof that it might literally connect to there having been some kind of structure there in this 1200 BC time frame.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's it works out real well. Unfortunately, I've not been able to verify that report any more than you've seen, but I would bet that it was part of the 1200 BC destruction because it was so massive at that time. We know, for example, that many parts of the world, like Britain and Germany, lost 9/10 of their human population all at once. So we're dealing with a massive, almost an extinction, a human extinction in various parts of the world all at the same time. And I think that that's entirely possible. That would explain also, perhaps, how this structure that's now found off of Cuba is where it is. We understand that possibly it was part of a much larger complex. I'm beginning to think that what they're finding there was something much larger originally, and that what they're finding now is just really a small part, a remnant. It was perhaps on a kind of a shelf which sank vertically. That's not impossible. Things like that have known to happen before in the Atlantic, and that this part remained upright, and that's what they're finding.
Until I interviewed Frank Joseph this weekend, I had not heard about this Cambridge, England conference on natural catastrophes during Bronze Age civilizations that was held in 1997, and the proceedings were released the following year. And they have a website, which I don't know if we would bring that website down, but I'll give it on the air. It's www.knowledge.co.uk/sis/cambproc.htm. And there you will see all of these papers. And the reason why I thought I would give that out on the air is this, what you have just heard Frank Joseph describe is a summary from this gigantic series of reports that were put together after this conference at Cambridge. And what I asked Frank was, how could there be this kind of evidence of a major catastrophe in 1200 B.C., and we don't hear about it?
Damn right. Like our own Navy telling us, for example.
Yeah, and he said that it mystifies him because the information is there, scientists know it, and here it is now beginning to emerge as being so relevant and important to the Atlantis,
there is no question about the fact that our Navy, which surely patrols the waters in and around Cuba, for example, and elsewhere, would absolutely have to know about this.
Yeah.
The Russian Navy would have to know about this. They've been in Cuban waters for a long time now.
And so, in that report that was sent to Frank Joseph that he put in the September-October Ancient American issue, the person who sent it said, and I'll read a little bit more beyond what I said before, we were there on a research project for the Spanish government about a week, but we were chased off the spot yesterday by Navy ships.
Oh.
Yes, and when they tried to send out the images from the underwater nine column, according to this report, which we're trying to find a person to talk with directly, they said their effort to get images out were jammed. Now, Could it be that it is a normal, just because the Navy is doing an exercise, it may have been an honest and inadvertent deflection? That's what we don't know.
Wouldn't be my first guess.
Yeah, and they are using the term in this report, jamming. But why? What is so dangerous about our learning that the world did not evolve the way that we have been taught?
Oh, Linda, you're answering your own question.
Well,
think about this. What's so dangerous about telling everybody that it didn't happen the way they've been telling us for all these years? Come on. It changes everything. Changes everything. Linda, we're here at the top of the hour. Hold on, all right?
We got more after.
I understand. Oh, my God. Is this interesting stuff or what? A worldwide catastrophic event 1,200 years before Christ that buried civilizations that existed before ours. Now, they not only have side-scan radar, sonar rather, but now they've got photographs of symbols a half a mile below the ocean. I'm Art Bell.
Riders on the storm, riders on the storm, into this house we're born.
You know, I see a lot of comments fast blasted to me on computer, and I thought John's in Baker City, Oregon was short, sweet, and to the point with regard to what this will do. He just said the information will upset the entire culture. Good! And it does have that, certainly it has that prospect, and that also could be an answer to why we haven't been told by those who we know it's there, Linda. I can't imagine any other answer that makes sense. Can you?
Well, I'll give you another perspective. Right. I talked with our archaeologist and anthropologist in Harvard, University of Pennsylvania, and other universities about this, and the reaction was unanimous. It cannot be, because nothing could be a half mile down,
yeah.
That the lowest that the oceans have been since the Ice Age is 400 feet below where they are now, not 2,200 feet. And when you say, well, there could be seismic activity or earthquake activity or a catastrophe that might have sent a portion of something straight down into the ocean, the response has always been, but everything would be broken up and there would be nothing to find. Well, stone and large stone might not break up floating down in the water.
That's
it,
right.
It depends. And what I'm trying to describe is that there is an, I'm going to call it an academic straitjacket. And that there are people, even like Dr. Ebert, at the University of Pennsylvania, who is doing pioneering, groundbreaking work right now in Turkmenistan. And he found that there are large, they call them oval states, where there is also a mysterious language carved on a stone that they found in the carbon layer that they could date at 2300 B.C. That's 4,300 years ago. And that means that writing was already in place then, and the Turkmenistan site is now rivaling anything in Samaria. Now, this has been happening also this year in many other places. And one of the most mysterious cultures on Earth are known as the Etruscans. And 2,500 years ago, they lived in a region of Italy known as Tuscany. No one knew who they were or where they came from, and the Etruscans were very skilled sailors and craftsmen, and they carved in stone blocks, columns, and other artifacts in a language that no one to date has ever been able to translate. It resembles Greek, but it is not Greek. And here I would like you to listen to Frank Joseph speculating about the letters that Paulina Zielitzky was trying to describe that are on the underwater stones off Cuba.
All right, here we go.
I haven't seen what they found down there. It sounds like if it's something that looks Greek but isn't Greek, my bet would be that it's Etruscan. And that, and I'm not saying that the site underwater is an Etruscan site. That's probably unlikely. The Etruscans did not build things that look like Teotihuacan, that's for sure. But the Etruscans, where did they get their written language? That's possible that what we're looking at in Etruscan is a variation of the Atlantean language. We don't know what the Atlantean written language looks like, but it appears to have been the precursor of not just Greek, but other written languages in other parts of the world. So it's possible that they, if they look to Etruscan, they might be able to find some similarities. That's not much of a help, though. Even if they identify it as Etruscan, they won't be able to read it, because the Etruscan written language has not yet been deciphered. They've gotten some names off of it and little snatches of things, but the language itself is still... It's really bizarre, because it's a Greek-type written language, but the language itself is more like Turkish or something. It's really very perplexing. The Etruscans, however, are, I'd say, are far more directly connected with Atlantis, because Plato, in his discussion of Atlantis, mentions the Etruscans specifically as having been an outpost of Atlantis, that the Atlanteans came to western Italy and set up their state there and intermarried with the people and sort of created the what became known as the Etruscans.
Now, from the work you have done on Atlantis research, and I think it's fair to say you're convinced that Plato's description and Herodotus of this Atlantean civilization, that it really did exist. What do you know about the Atlantean culture in that period of 3000 to 1200 BC based on what you've studied?
What I can tell you is that the Atlanteans who developed on an island outside of the Straits of Gibraltar developed an extremely powerful sea civilization, as it were. They were great seafarers. Plato describes the Atlanteans as great seafarers and great miners, and that works out extremely well with the copper mining that took place in North America. I'm not going to get into that, but there was a major copper mining enterprise which involved a minimum of half a billion tons of raw copper being removed and disappearing during that time period. And I believe that the Atlanteans fit the bill for that.
And this was the 5,000 mines in the northern peninsula of Michigan that are each about 60 feet deep.
Well, the average depth is probably more like 20 feet deep for the pit mines,
mm-hmm.
but there were many pit mines that were excavated through solid rock 60 feet down. So whoever did that obviously had a technology far beyond anything that was known to the Native Americans at that time, who were not interested in anything more than float copper, copper they picked up off the ground. But this is, of course, one of the great, I don't really hate to use the word conspiracy, but it certainly is suppressed evidence that American scholars have known about for more than 100 years, that there was a huge copper mining enterprise in upper Michigan that lasted from 3000 BC to 1200 BC, those magic dates again, in which a minimum, a bare minimum of half a billion pounds of the world's highest grade copper was excavated and disappeared. Meanwhile, on the opposite side of the world, a Bronze Age erupts, and bronze is only made through high grade copper combined with zinc and tin.
Hmm.
So I think that what Plato was talking about are these ancient copper miners who were able to mine through their tremendous technological development and ship this huge, this prodigious amount of raw copper to Europe, where they became the merchants, the brokers, the copper barons of the ancient world, and that's what made them so phenomenally wealthy and powerful.
Well, an interesting possible discovery in this we'll call it underwater megalithic site that's under research, is that in some of the sonar data, not the videotape, but the sonar data, there are some returns that suggest that there might be metal, like metal on the tops of some of the objects. Would the use of metal, of sheeting on structures, be something that would be associated with the research on Atlantis?
Well, now we are getting really close to the Atlantean realm. Plato tells us that the Atlanteans, at the height of their prosperity, to show off their wealth, would actually sheet their walls, their outer walls of the city, with great sheets of what he called aurichalcum. Aurichalcum means nothing more than high-grade copper, which didn't exist in Europe in large numbers in North America. So here were people who used a design technique, an architectural technique of including sheets of precious metal in their walls. And now we're finding this supposedly at a site underwater off of Cuba. I would say now we're beginning to narrow in on a cultural commonality.
Frank, where do you think all of this is headed?
I know exactly where it's headed. Sometime this century, the greatest archaeological find in history is going to be made when identifiable remains of Atlantis are going to be found. And the beginnings of that started in 1968 when they found the Bimini Road or the Bimini Wall, whatever they refer to it as. It's still highly controversial, but it was just the first. That place has been thoroughly established as artifactual and man-made. The structure in Cuba may be part of that. It's very possible that's part of it. But they are breadcrumbs on the trail. And the final discovery of Atlantis is going to be made because the technology now is for underwater research is developing at such an extent they're turning the oceans transparent. And what's under the oceans, which actually is hidden under the silt and so on. And I think a lot of Atlantis is probably buried not only under the water but under the silt as well. And that discovery is going to be made. That's where it's heading. I think that hopefully in our lifetime, but I would say definitely in the 21st century, Atlantis will be found. I'm really confident that that's going to happen.
What happens to the academic world then?
It stood on its ear because the academic world has been demanding for the last 100 years that anybody who believes in Atlantis is... somebody believes in fantasy, they don't know what they're talking about, it's very unscientific. Beyond that, they say that, of course, civilization began just 5,000 years ago very slowly in Mesopotamia between the Tigris and the Euphrates. Well, all that's got to be thrown out. We're going to be looking at something completely different now. And we have, in other words, all of the textbooks, our entire concept of where we came from is going to have to be changed. But...
Yeah, Art.
Linda, God, doesn't this verify so much of what some archaeologists have talked to us about with regard to the forbidden archaeology we've all heard about?
I think so. I've looked at that Appendix B in that big, huge forbidden archaeology that goes into what appears to be pieces of equipment and technology and all sorts of things going back maybe thousands and thousands of years. And one of the this whole issue about the copper mining in northern Minnesota and the fact that archaeologists have known that there was all of this copper out of what looked like boreholes going into this northern peninsula of Michigan, and that they are very old, and that it is an example of something that relates to what Plato wrote about in the Critias so clearly. And it also, this little passage I'm going to read, underscores, if you can sort of in your mind's eye think about the colors and what I'm describing now from Plato in the Critias.
Right.
What a strange but probably extremely beautiful place this was. Mm. First of all, think of a bullseye. Think of multiple rings. The center was the Temple of Poseidon, and as it went alternating from the center, water, land, water, land, water, land, in these big rings. And now I'm picking up from Plato. The stone they quarried beneath the central island all around and from beneath the outer and inner circles, some of it being white, some black, and some red. They wove a pattern of many of these colors by blending the stones for the sake of ornament so as to confer upon the buildings a natural charm. So now you've got three colors, red, white, and black. And they covered with brass, as though with a plaster, all the circumference of the wall which surrounded the outermost circle. And that of the inner one they coated with tin, and that which encompassed the Acropolis itself with aurichalcum,
which sparkled like fire. That is the raw, pure copper that Frank Joseph and others are convinced was mined from the northern peninsula of Michigan in North America.
Wow.
The royal palace within the Acropolis was arranged in this manner. In the center, there stood a temple sacred to Poseidon, which was reserved as holy ground and encircled with a wall of gold.
Hmm.
So you had metal surfaces, according to Plato, all around these rings of alternating water and land, and that everything was built of red, white, and black.
Whew. Linda, two questions. First of all, I guess the statement, don't you think it's a basic tenet or belief of humanity in general that we believe in our own survival? In other words, the ground we stand on, we simply don't question the fact that it could have all been different at one time, that continents could have disappeared. And any worldwide catastrophic event at any time in our history has got to mean there's at least a possibility that it could happen again, right?
Yes.
If it happens once, it could happen twice.
Yes, and in this absolutely important 1997 gathering at Cambridge in England, one of the things that is underscored as you look through the titles and the abstracts on these papers is they are saying that there were maybe five major events in a period going back maybe between even 2300 and 1200 BC, but that we're talking about things coming in some sort of a cosmic nature, cycles perhaps, this collision. Think about this, a collision of comets that rain down around a band of the Earth. And as Frank was pointing out, depending upon the velocity and the size, we already today have all of these warnings and concerns about any kind of incoming asteroid, and it's measured, that the impact is measured the way we would measure atomic bombs or hydrogen bombs.
That's because people feel this, Linda. Have you ever listened to Native Americans? They talk about comets. Comets having deep meaning for all of humanity. And a lot of what the Native Americans say would fit right in, piece for piece for piece, with what you're telling me right now.
Yeah, and when our government back in, gosh, I think it was like around 1990, 89, 90, somewhere in there, for the very first time, you started seeing those very first headlines about we need some kind of defense against asteroids.
That's right. That's right. Even the Catholic Church, Linda, has had all sorts of interest in what's going on in deep space and what might be approaching Earth, to the degree that they have pushed aside environmental concerns to get observatories built in places where nobody else could get them built. I mean, pressure, serious pressure from the Vatican to get this done, because they're watching for something.
Yes, and all of us should be watching the skies and trying to get as much information as possible, not turning away from it, trying to understand what happened on this planet 1200 BC.
But Linda, it's human.
Be very relevant to now.
Linda, it's human nature to turn away from it. It's a basic tenet, a belief of ours, that everything we know and think of around us is solid. And if it once wasn't solid, it might not be solid again. Linda, hold on. We're at the bottom of the hour. When we get back, I think I'll ask when this is going to really be breaking news in the mainstream press. I wonder how long they can keep this bottled up. Until you and I are gone, until the next generation comes, I don't think they can wait that long. I mean, look at how it's breaking on this program. We'll be right back. One quick question I think I would like to ask. We heard some speculation that this story might not be really well known or thoroughly believed. I'm not sure how to say this, until perhaps another generation passes. However, with the work going on in Cuba by Ms. Zelitsky and company, it seems to me it might be known much sooner. Or will the academic community decide to simply ignore hard, even hard, evidence of this? Or do you think in our lifetimes, Linda, that all of this might hit the mainstream press thanks to National Geographic and what's going on in figures? It would have to come out of Cuba, of all places. Maybe they just don't care that much about upsetting paradigms. Who knows? But Linda, could it break in our lifetimes?
Well, I'll tell you, Art, the National Geographic Society is so convinced about the seriousness of this underwater site that they tried in their contractual discussions with Paulina Zelitsky and Paul Weinzweig to basically tie up everything. National Geographic really wanted everything, and their negotiations broke down because of it. And as of this month, there are still discussions about what ADC Corp is doing. They have other contractual agreements both in Cuba and other places in Australia and Canada. And they are going forward. They are completely independent. They are not dependent upon National Geographic or anybody else. It's a very unusual position for them to be in. And right now, as Paulina and her husband said earlier in the interview, the only two factors they're really concerned about now and what's preventing them from showing the world the images, they want to do that, and that is the weather and equipment. She explained to me that that part of the sea is especially treacherous, that it is extremely dangerous. It is where high winds blow all of the time, and they have problems when they've got wind on the surface and what it does as they go down. And they're trying to wait to do what they hope will be the definitive videotape with multiple cameras and lights within the next 2 months. So and they have promised me that when we get to that point and they are going to go down, they will share some images with me. And I will do a story next as soon as something is firm with images. So,
Do you see a point where the mainstream press throws up its hands, courtesy of the investigation of National Geographic or Ms. Zelitsky or whatever, and comes out and says, oh, my God, here it is, folks. Do you see that happening, or do you see academia simply turning their backs?
I think that the general world media is going to be forced to have to deal with the facts in a story like this. If you have indisputable videotape of 90-degree cornered, we'll call them stones. They call Stonehenge the stones, but they are clearly have been carved. And if the there's hieroglyphs and symbols and writing, it would be especially interesting if the writing turned out to match something of the mysterious Etruscan language. And it's 2,200 feet down, Art. You have to deal with this as a serious underwater archaeological discovery.
And this could surely occur not in our children's lifetime, but in our lifetime, and pretty doggone soon at that, actually.
Yes, I really do think that Paulina Zelitsky and Paul Weinzweig are expecting that they will be doing something public with this story in early 2002 with images. I think that's what they're building up for. And whether or not ABC Television, National Geographic, or whoever else wants to get into this, I think that we've got the problem that you can't get the world in an ROV down 2,200 feet. And you can't get the world down through the Cuban government. This is something that I have learned in the process of keeping up with this story. You have to have hundreds, it seems like, a lot of permissions. You have to have exactly the right people who give you those permissions in Cuba, or you don't do anything. And the fact that Paulina Zalitsky has been working as an ocean engineer and in construction on Cuba for many different phases of her life, she knows that culture, and she is able to operate in it. But you or I or somebody else, we can't, just because we want to go to Cuba and cover this story, it doesn't mean that we're going to be able to go down in the ROV or have access to it. And so suddenly, it's a very small channel of the information coming through ADC Corporation, and they understand that. But they are also working with the Cuban Marine Museum. They are working with scientists there. Cuba is interested in this as a story that that government would be dealing with. So you have all of these different factors, but I have never had one sense that Paulina Zalitsky or Paul Weinswag have any other goal but to report whatever it is that they can photograph and find when they've got it corroborated really well to the world. I think they want to do it. I certainly want to do it. And so it really is a story in which the pressure of fact is what's going to be at work here.
What a totally monstrous story. Linda, we're going to get phones at least in the last hour, but I really would be remiss if I did not ask you the following. Don Robertson of Ventura, California writes, glad you're back. Please ask Linda Moulton Howe if there have been any new developments. After all, before the war, it was a giant story, in proving the Chilbolton Code, the face, genuine as genuine crop formations, not hoax. Dr. Roger Lear has a friend that claims the code received at Chilbolton is genuine, and whoever sent it examined it from a three-dimensional aspect instead of the two-dimensional aspect it was set in 1974. This man is one of the world's foremost experts in the Human Genome Research Project, but wishes to remain anonymous as he works for a major lab with security restrictions. So, Chilbolton, I understand Dr. Levin Good has now examined some of the wheat from the formations. Is that correct?
That's right.
What do we know?
Okay, he got soil and plant samples from three formations in England. One was the gigantic Milk Hill, 787 feet in diameter, 409 circles. And the other was from the Chilbolton Face and Code, which I have a kind of funny, perhaps inspiring story about, that the day that Lucy Pringle went up in the air for the first time and
right.
photographed that it was a face, she got in touch with me. And I was working then over the next 2 or 3 days trying to figure out what can we do to get something that we could do scientifically. And on the day before the farmer cut the whole thing down, I stayed up all day and all night, literally, trying to find out who the farmer was. And nobody knew. Lucy didn't know. Nobody knew who actually controlled that wheat field next to the Chilbolton Observatory. And at what was 5 o'clock in the morning, East Coast time, 10 o'clock in England in the summer, I finally got a woman at an office that Charles Mallett had called and said, I think that we have found the farmer. And I've been through so many phone calls that were dead ends, and I made that call, 5 o'clock, sun coming up, and a woman answered, and she said very cheerily that this was the office, yes, of the farmer who owned and ran that wheat field, yes, and where was he? He was on the harvester in the field. And I gave the speech of my life, saying I was a reporter in Philadelphia trying to work on the science of the soil and the crops. Was there any possibility he had a cell phone? And she said, yes. And she gave me the phone number. And I called it, and this man answered, and there was this roar of this harvester.
Oh, no.
And I said, are you by any chance in the Chilbolton field? He said, yes, I'm getting ready to harvest. And I gave the second speech of my life and asked him, begging, would he please preserve it for one day while we would get people out there to sample the soil and the plants. And at first he said no, and I kept on talking about why it was important, and finally he said, okay, you have until tomorrow morning.
Oh my God.
Literally, I mean, that's how close this was. He was on the harvester getting ready to plow through them.
Oh man.
So, you know, it shows that sometimes you persevere against all odds, it pays off.
Sometimes, I guess speeches have power, Linda.
Well,
who do you have go out? I mean, who went out?
Okay, Charles Mallett and his wife, Frances, who I've known ever since I worked on my book, Mysterious Lights and Crop Circles, bless their hearts. They went out, they sampled plants, they sampled soil, they took video, they took photographs, and we did get it to Dr. Levengood, the biophysicist in Michigan. And when his report came back, it's very interesting. I will start first with Milk Hill, because this is where he had remarkable changes across the board.
All right, folks. Again, that's the great big one, the 409 circles. Yes.
The growth nodes were lengthened. They had expulsion cavities.
Oh, my.
Yeah, the cavities were even down to the microscopic level, and you can see photographs that Dr. Levengood took, a magnification of 40 power, at my website. It is a story that I filed October 27th.
Linda, stop and explain to everybody what an expulsion cavity is. What does that mean?
When, think in your mind of a wheat stalk that is growing up out of the soil.
Right.
And about 3 or 4 inches above the soil, there is a nodule in the stem. And about every 4 to 5 inches, there will be another nodule, and it will end up being 4 of these nodules. They're called growth nodes, and at the top will be the wheat. And each of those growth nodes will have the most water in the stem. They are the growth nodes. Dr. Levengood hypothesizes from every work that he has done, every test he's done in labs now for about 8 years, working with microwave frequencies, that he can only reproduce what he finds in the crop formations, such as these expulsion cavities, when he exposes the plant to microwave energy.
Basically cooking them with
microwaves.
Yes,
but they don't cook. This is one of the remarkable things about crop formations. He has never, in all of these years, and maybe thousands of plants by now, he has never seen a cooked plant, but he has seen many of these expulsion cavities, which are the result
of some kind of energy, right?
From the water is being vibrated by the microwave energy, just like you would put coffee into a microwave oven to heat it up.
Now, that doesn't mean microwaves did it. It means that's the best way we can simulate it.
Well, yes, but it means microwaves were involved in the field. That's a very important point. Yes, microwave energies are interacting with the plants and the soil.
So he's really locked it down to where he definitely believes it is microwave energy?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. He published this a few years back, and this is why the holes burst out in the growth nodes, because the water is vibrated up to a point that it can't go anywhere, and suddenly, like steam, it bursts out, and these are the holes. And when you go to earthfiles.com in the Real X Files section, you will see this October 27th story of mine shows his own photographs of these expulsion nodes that he found all over the plants from Milk Hill. He found the nodes were also lengthened, and he has a photograph here of another very important part of Milk Hill, which is he discovered that the wheat seed weights from the inside the formation were significantly reduced compared to the normal control wheat samples that are taken outside the formation for comparison. But when the Milk Hill seeds were germinated under controlled laboratory conditions along with normal seeds from outside the formation,
right,
the Milk Hill plants had a 111% increase in the mean growth rate compared to the controls.
Wow.
This accelerated growth is something that he has seen right from the beginning of his research. Other people in Canada and different states in the United States and Europe, they have reproduced this. They find that seeds coming from inside formations when planted have accelerated growth compared to normal seeds.
Question for you, Linda. If you virtually cook a wheat with a microwave, does it then, when you take the seeds, exhibit the same accelerated growth characteristics?
Yes. He has.
It does. Oh.
He has, not only has he worked with this in the lab, he has now developed a patent using energy systems to accelerate
growth
rate.
Linda, is there any way in the world, and I'm sure there have been a lot of tests with regard to this, that anybody with boards and chains can produce this effect, no matter how they hop and jump and move around? Is there any even one time evidence that these kind of things have occurred with people with boards and chains?
Let me read from Dr. Levengood's own report, quote, "These pronounced growth differences are never observed under normal conditions. What we are observing here is that seeds from the formation samples that showed reduced seed weights are germinating and growing at faster rates than seeds from the sample sets taken outside the formation, and that microwave energies have to have been involved, not people's feet."
Whew. That throws the whole thing wide open again.
Well, there's one more step here.
Yes.
He also found higher than normal deposits of magnetic material in the soil samples in Elk Hill.
You know, I heard that report from a number of people who were over there who took magnetometer readings, Linda, and they said they were anomalous all over the place. The magnetometer was jumping like crazy.
Well, down in the soil, and he's been finding this from Israel and Canada and Europe, that they, at a microscopic level, up to 700 times the normal soil in the world, that he's finding this magnetite. This is iron that will jump to a magnet, and it, for some reason, becomes concentrated in some of the soils in formations, which he continues to study, and in the Milk Hill Formation, compared to the soil outside the formation, there was, again, an unusual concentration of magnetic iron in the soil.
Did you say 700 times normal?
Yes, he has measured in some soils in formations up to 700 times the amount of magnetic iron compared to normal soil. And he hypothesizes that these magnetic particles are consistent with, and I'm quoting again from his report, "the physics of forces that would include microwave energies on magnetic particles suspended within a rotating vortex system of ions."
Wow.
In other words, a spinning plasma, which would keep that word in mind
plasma?
When we talk about Hedstolen, Norway.
I heard your report on Dreamland Saturday, Linda.
It's a heck of a story.
Yeah, on the plasma. We'll get to that. Everybody,
when we come back, Jill Bolton.
Yeah, that's right. Stay right there, everybody. Jill Bolton, and you're going to want to hear about the plasma as well, and we will get phone lines open. Boy, talk about a night for breaking news. Holy mackerel. I'm Art Bell, back in more ways than one with Linda Moulton Howe. As I said, coming up in a few moments, questions for Linda Moulton Howe. And boy, oh boy, what a lot of news tonight. Once again, here is Linda, and I think we were going to cover Jill Bolton, Linda.
Right, and we can do it pretty briefly because Dr. Levengood did not find any lengthened notes, no expulsion cavities, no seed weight changes, no increased growth rate, or greater concentration of magnetic soil. Magnetic iron in the soil of either Chilbolton formation. And the absence of those findings might mean that the source of the Chilbolton formations was not the same as Milk Hill. And he, Dr. Levengood and I talked about that. He said in the absence of the physical changes that he saw in Milk Hill, he cannot prove or disprove what happened at Chilbolton. One of the things that the phenomena has done from year to year is keep changing things, and that's one of the almost expectations we've had. And there also is the possibility that some human intelligence agency decided to do this. We don't know. It's just the bottom line is that the same complexity of changes in Milk Hill we did not find in either of the formations at Chilbolton. And when it comes to what is making Milk Hill and the other major mysterious formations over the last 12 or 15 years,
we still have no idea.
We get down to an issue of intelligence, a sense of intelligence that many people have had in the presence of the mysterious lights that are so commonly involved with the formations. And that ranges from the Dutch man who says that he thinks that the lights are angels, to others who call them other dimensional frequencies. And what exactly that means, I don't know.
All right, Linda, I would love to take some calls. And I'm sure a lot of people are going to want to communicate with you. I gave my email address out, artbell@mindspring.com. Let's give yours out, because I'm sure a lot of people are going to have comments and questions about this.
Yes, thanks. My email is earthfiles@earthfiles.com. And the website is www.earthfiles.com.
All right. earthfiles@earthfiles.com. That is your email address.
Right.
All right. Linda, here we go. Let's take some questions. First-time caller line, you're on the air with Linda Moulton Howe. Where are you, please?
This is Ken in Seattle.
Hello, Ken.
I have sent you a bunch of pictures over the years of Seattle contrails in a store called Area 51, and I've listened to you for years, but I wanted to ask Linda. I've got this wonderful Arizona magazine in front of me from September 64, and the ancient manuscripts on American stone.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to get too far into it, but this man started in 1938 with the petroglyphs in Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
And he spoke to an Aztec down there in 1938, and he said that the ancestors of the Aztecs came over routes in which they migrated. They marked all of their routes. Their forebears was the Nahuatl tribes, who came from Atlantis, crossed overland to the valley of the Great Salt Lake. Later, they migrated from there to the valley of the River Gila, and that established their first capital. After living there several centuries, they moved on to the Mexican Plateau. And they have wonderful examples of the petroglyphs from all over the world, in Greece and Mexico, and
mm-hmm.
the similarities between them all.
Well, then there's a pretty good chance this really is connected, isn't there, Linda?
I think that if Frank Joseph were with us right now, that he could give us many examples of what he thinks is demonstrative hard physical evidence in the North American continent of these Atlantean outposts that were involved with mining and other things. And I think that there is another subcategory of story that will continue to be emerging over the next few years, and that is in the United States, in several places, like in Ohio and down in the Grand Canyon, there are discoveries of everything ranging from masks and really exotic pottery and glyphs that seem to tie directly to a Mesopotamian origin. What are they? Why are they here? And why is it that people who have tried to report about some of these very odd underground or in the canyon discoveries can't get anywhere with those reports? And Frank Joseph is working on a story right now that, depending upon how it continues to evolve with physical evidence, could be another one that may erupt in the next two or three years, establishing this Mesopotamian or Middle Eastern or even Egyptian connection
to some outpost here in North America.
All right. Wild Card Line, you're on the air with Linda Moulton, Hal and Art Bell. Good morning.
Good morning. This is Frank from Cleveland.
Yes, Frank. Hi.
Mr. Bell, Ms. Howell.
Hello.
I would like to know if you're familiar with the book called The Blue Book. Okay, with UFO and everything.
Yes, of course, sir.
Oh,
okay.
Yeah.
How about The Face of Mars?
No, yes, sir. These are all things that have been constantly discussed here.
The connection with what we've been talking about, or what you have talking about, have been talking about, as far as the 409 rings and everything. There's a definite connection with Atlantis, I think.
Well, there may be a connection with artifacts on Mars, if that's what they ever turn out to be. There's certainly reason to believe that there could be some sort of connection with very ancient artifacts on Mars and very ancient artifacts here. It's a stretch right now, but what you have heard tonight is not